Hello. Well, it's great to be here. And before I start, I'd just like to introduce my lovely assistant, Michael. he's going to be putting some photographs of people up on this board, but if you can, just ignore him. And we'll come back to him at the end of the talk. I was asked almost a year ago if I would give this talk, and I was absolutely amazed. I was like, oh, this is, well, yeah, wow, fantastic. And a brilliant day in my diary. And then they said, oh, by the way, you do know it's a motivational session. A what? I know absolutely nothing about motivation. And I was beginning to panic. I'm thinking, I'm not Muhammad Ali. You know, I can't fly like a butterfly. I can't sting like a bee. I'm not Tanny Gray Thompson. I'm not Ranulph Fiennes. And I was beginning to panic. Had no idea what I was going to say. And then... About a month ago, I was giving a talk at some conference study day, and the organizer sent me the comments, the email, you know, the feedback. And the very first one said, this session really motivated me to go back to my workplace and make changes. And I thought, that's it. I don't need to climb Everest, because the stuff that we do every day matters. The stuff that we do saves lives. So for the talk today, I'm going to tell you about my homies, the infection prevention team at Leicester, and the work that they do. And I hope you realize that they're people just like you. Okay, so let me tell you about our journey. Let me tell you about what we've been doing. It all started way back in about 2008 with this lady here, Karen Weaver. She's our lead tissue viability nurse. And she said, what's happening in theatres? What's going on? Because my vacuum dressing budget has gone through the roof. What's happening with infections in theatres? And we said, we don't know, but let's get a team together. So the infection prevention team pulled another team together, and we said, let's do some surveillance. And what was crucial, the key feature about this surveillance pilot was we did post-discharge surveillance, and we did top-notch post-discharge surveillance. We did. We had a surveillance nurse, an independent surveillance nurse, who telephoned every single patient on day 10, day 20, and day 30. Now, not surprisingly, our infection rates were sky high. So colorectal, 27%, breast, 10%. But what we found during the surveillance program, we found lots of other things, other issues, that we were able to change practice. We found that the average cost for treating one of our colorectal wounds was $10,500, and the average cost for treating one of our breast infections was $1,500. And we found that primary care were picking up the tab for about a quarter of those costs. So when primary care found out, said, let's set up some sequin targets. And that was helpful because it was a driver for change. When the chief exec found out how the rate and the cost, he said, right, you need to sort it out. And the IP team put together a proposal, and we managed to get a trust-wide surveillance program with six staff. We found that smoking was our biggest risk factor for wound infections for our breast patients. So we changed our patient information leaflet and to include smoking, stop smoking if you can, just before the surgery. And we also teamed up with primary care, and we set up a smoking cessation program in the GP surgeries. We found out that 40% of the women who had breast surgery developed seromas, and that each woman had an average of 8 visits to the seroma clinic, where she'd have a syringe inserted into her breast and the fluid drawn out, an average of 8 visits, 40% of the women. We looked, we said, why is it so high? We realised we had no guidelines for when you should drain a seroma. We looked around, there's no national guidelines for when you drain a seroma. So the breast nurses got together and came up with some guidelines, and that's reduced our the average number of visits the women have. Vacuum dressings. We discovered that our patients were delayed in hospital. Their discharge was delayed for one night, £400, delayed for one night while they had the vacuum dressing set up. patients who were discharged with the vacuum dressings, a quarter of them had the vacuum dressings removed within 24 hours because the primary care nurses didn't know how to work with those vacuum dressings. So we ended up working more closely with the tissue viability nurses in the community to try and make it a more seamless service. We were very worried that the hospital would not let us publish and tell anybody because we were a bit worried that we'd look bad. But to our surprise, the hospital said, no, go out there, publish, tell everybody, because you want to raise the profile. You want to say that if you do good surveillance, these are the realistic infection rates. This is what you get. So that was very encouraging. Now, what happens then is it's like a ball that keeps on rolling. From this project, we ended up with lots of other projects. This. This is Dave Jenkins. This is him. He's the one on the right, clearing the dance floor there. And what he realised was that if we wanted managers, if we wanted to persuade them to part with money and pay for interventions or to pay for IP staff, we had to convince them that it was cost effective. So what Dave is doing, he's currently doing some work on finding out what is the actual cost of all the infections to our hospital, not somewhere else, how much is it costing to our hospital? And that's the information that we need as leverage to be able to persuade managers. This is Matthew. He's one of the IP team. He's responsible for the general surgical wards. And he said, what if, these rates, you know, our rates are high. What if we blitz our patients for 6 months? Let's do everything that we can to reduce the infection rates. Let's give them 100% compliance with all the interventions. So we teamed up with these rogues here. I'm sure many of you recognize Martin Kiernan and Dave Leeper. And what we did was, for 6 months at the end of last year, we had a project nurse, and they went round trying to get 100% compliance with all the HII interventions for surgical site infection. So massive focus on getting our infection rates down. Now, we wanted to see what happened to the SSI rates over that period. Now, this was just a pilot. Well, the bad news was that our infection rates didn't come down. But we did find out something else, something about staff engagement and feedback. Before we started the care bundle, we did quarterly reporting, okay? Quarterly reporting, and the document was several pages thick, right? And it went out to kind of like the senior sort of infection meetings. But for the care bundle, we said what we'll do is we'll have just one page, and it goes up monthly, and it goes up on the scrub room sink, on the doors of the anaesthetic rooms, on the coffee room doors, in the wards, and in the theatres, everywhere where anybody involved could see it. Now, we've got two hospitals in our trust at Leicester that do colorectal surgery. We've got the Royal and the General. So after the first month of the study, put it up. Last month, 6 infections, colorectal surgery. Right. So when we went to the Royal, they said, yeah, but those infections, they probably happened over at the General. Right. And when we went to the General, they said, yeah, those infections probably happened over at the Royal. Right. Okay, so we changed our sheet. The Royal, infections at the General. Okay, the next month it went up. And they said, yeah, but those are probably superficial infections. They don't really count. Okay. So the next month, the Royal, the General, superficial, deep. Huh? And they said, yeah, but those infections, they're probably emergency patients. Okay? The Royal, the General, elective, emergency, superficial, deep. Right? Huh? And they said, yeah, well, you're bound to get some infections, aren't you? Okay? So we changed tack. Let's not have numbers, because people, they think you're bound to have some. So what we'll do is we'll look at compliance, okay? That's when things changed. So it went up and it said, last month at the General, 3 elective patients did not get antibiotics before knife to skin. And that's when the chief anaesthetist said, name names. Who was it? And that's when things changed, because people began to take individual, personal responsibility. Okay? So that was great for us. We'd learned something about engaging with staff. Now, I was feeding the results from this, the care bundle, back to the gorgeous Liz, who's our lead IP nurse. And I was a bit down because our overall findings had shown that all the work we'd done, getting, you know, increasing compliance, the SSI rate hadn't come down. But Liz here was very excited, right? Let me tell you what Liz was very excited about. This pre-op warming, this was one of the interventions we'd done. This is when you warm the patients up on the wards before they come to surgery. This was the one thing, when we did the analysis, we looked at logistic regression, we looked at the one thing, this was the one thing that stood out for reducing our SSI rates. So let me show you. If you look here, patients who had no pre-op warming, superficial SSI rate of 22%. The patients who were pre-op warmed, superficial SSI rate, 0%. And Liz was very excited about this. And this is what's great about if you're able to work with a team of people, because when I was a bit, you know, nothing's, you know, this hasn't worked, she was, right, what can we do next? Who do we need to speak to? How do we take this forward? What's happening now? So that was great. If I go back and remind you of our very first, how all it started for us. Remember this one down here about when we went and disseminated widely? So speaking study days, and people from other hospitals came to our hospital to visit us and have a look at how we did the surveillance. Now, lots of people said, we would love to do really good surveillance. We'd love to do it properly and do the post-discharge and follow up every patient. But we're worried. We're scared. Because if we do good surveillance, our infection rates will go sky high. And then when we report that to the HPA, we become branded as outliers, and then we get penalised. And we said, that can't be right. Surely not. I mean, surely everybody does the same thing with the surveillance programme if there's benchmarking involved. Let's have a look at it. Let's have a look at the national surveillance system, because we are putting out all of our SSI rates. We don't want to be compared, you know, against somebody doing something different. So we teamed up with these rogues again, the IP team at our hospital, and we sent questionnaires out to all the acute trusts in England. There's about 156 of them. We got a fantastic response, 107 trusts. And if there's anybody out here who responded, thank you very much. That's just absolutely fantastic. So 107 trusts responded and told us how they collected their surveillance data. Let me just show you some of the findings. We got quite excited about this. Look, post-discharge, two-thirds, 67 of the trusts do post-discharge surveillance. So we got quite excited. This is absolutely brilliant. But there's a but coming. 30 trusts did not send all the data they collected to the HPA. Interesting. So what didn't they send? They didn't send post-discharge data. They only sent mandatory data. They collected other stuff, but they only sent mandatory. And if they collected continuous data, you know, like the whole year, they only sent 3 months' worth of that. They kept the rest. And it was at this point when Martin Kiernan said, this is really interesting. He said, this is great. And I was like, is it? And he said, this is great. He said, this means that trusts are doing it for themselves. They're doing surveillance because they want to know what's going on in their trust, not because they have to satisfy the HPA. They're doing it because they want to find out and make changes, improvements in their own organisations. And I thought, oh, God, yeah, that's great. Okay. All right. Let me tell you some more things. Apples and oranges. When we looked at whatever we did, there were so many inconsistencies, there were so many variations, there were so many different issues with quality, with data control, data collection methods, that there's no way it's possible to benchmark this data. Let me show you some things. 10% of the trusts said they only presented inpatient-only data to the HPA. 10% said they didn't report superficial data. 10% used a different definition of SSI. And then there were several different data collection methods used, and these had a huge impact on SSI rates. For example, post-discharge surveillance. We collected together all the trusts, right, all of the trusts, those 67 of them, all of the trusts that said they did post-discharge surveillance, right? And then we separated them out, high quality, low quality, okay? So they all did PDS, all did post-discharge surveillance, but we separated the high quality and the low quality. Now let me show you the figures for the trusts which do not just post-discharge surveillance, but high quality post-discharge surveillance. Right, this is a HIP. So nine trusts, well, in 2010, 2011, 1.3%, 1.6%. Now, the HPA says it's 0.8%. Okay, so it's double. We did the same thing for knee surgery. So all hospital, all trusts that did post-discharge, and then we separated it up into high-quality post-discharge, low-quality post-discharge. 3.4%, this is knee surgery. 3.4%, 3.5%. The HPA says it's 0.6%. Six times higher. This is Sue Davey. She's our lead for surveillance. And Sue said, you know, all the work that we've been doing, we're talking about rates, we're talking about numbers, we're talking about costs. Where's the patient in all of this? So we said, okay, let's do some interviews. And we did 17 interviews with patients who had deep wound infections. Okay, remember, this is deep, deep wound infections. And the first shock, surprise, that we got was during the recruitment phase of the study. I got a reply slip, came to me, and it was from a patient, and it said, I don't know why you asked me to take part in this study, because I never had a wound infection. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to get sacked for sending stuff out to patients. Anyway, so and I'm going to get hauled up before, you know, the R&D committee at the hospital. But just before I do, I'll phone Sue just to quick and check. So I phone Sue. Mr. Smith says he never had a wound infection. Hold on. Click, click, click. He said, oh, here he is. He was readmitted. He had his wound reopened by a surgeon, and he had three cycles of antibiotics. Mr. Smith was not alone. 9 out of the 17 patients with deep wound infections did not know that they had wound infections. Let me read you one of their quotes. I didn't realise I had an infection. When I got your letter to take part in the study, I thought, where's the infection? There may have been one, but the hospital never told me about it. We think maybe that infections aren't that important, surgical site infections aren't that important. One of the nurses said to a patient with a deep wound, it's nothing to worry about, it's not MRSA. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what the patient said. I can't cope, I can't cope, I just can't do this. There was a stage when I wanted to die. I was in utter despair. And there was another woman who talked about her children. She said, my children woke up in the night screaming. There were also financial costs to the patients. All of the patients who had been in work at the start of the surgery had now been off work for so long that all of them were on reduced pay. My partner had to get a job, otherwise we couldn't pay the mortgage. They talked about a lack of support in the community. It was frightening, it was isolated. And they also talked about going from pillar to post, trying to find somebody who would diagnose their developing symptoms. Let me read you this quote. I was crying. I was not well at all. I couldn't keep a drink down. The GP came and said, what do you expect? You've had major surgery. And I started to think I was going mad. Perhaps you're supposed to feel like this. My husband was at his wit's end. He didn't know what to do. He called NHS Helpline, and they said to buy some anti-sickness tablets from the chemist. He rang the hospital. They weren't very helpful. He rang the ward, and they said, she's been discharged, so there's nothing we can do. Then after 3 or 4 days, I was getting terrific pains in my stomach, and I felt like I'd wet myself. I looked down, and there was a lot of blood just gushing out of me. 3 of the people that we'd spoken to ended up as 999 A&E readmissions. But what this has all led us to do is our next project. We're now working with the tissue viability nurses in the community and also the tissue viability nurses again in the hospital to see how can we provide support for patients in the community with developing symptoms. The Royal College of Surgeons says there are 4.2 million operations in England each year alone. Now, if we have a conservative estimate of a wound infection rate of 5%, that's one patient diagnosed in England with a wound infection every 2 minutes. Michael, how many pictures have you got up? 10. Since I started talking, 10 people in England have been diagnosed with a wound infection. That's 10 people whose children wake up in the night screaming, 10 people who can't pay the mortgage, 10 people who just want to die. This has been our journey at Leicester with the IP team over the past 5 years. But what about you? Tell me about your journey. Where is it going to take you? Thank you.